I have these friends, Dan and Sheila. Actually, they're podcast hosts.
Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Sheila.
And we're joined today by a very special guest, Blank Reg.
Yeah, Blank Reg. I'm from the future.
And how far into the future?
Dystopian future of Max Headroom. Actually, I was wondering what year I'm actually from.
The answer is 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah. 20 minutes in the future. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, so I'm 20 minutes in the future.
Anyway, yes, for this very special Sunday show, we're going to have a digressive chat about some annoying things that have been coming up in movies lately, starting with a little something called The Flash. So yeah, you recently watched this?
I watched it today.
Okay.
For the first time. So yeah, so I watched, because I think I was the one who suggested this kind of topic to you guys. And I think it was a larger topic of sort of like just the way movies have been going for the last, 30 years, let's say. And I would say contrasting, let's say, the height of practical effects in, let's say, the 1980s and early 1990s with, I'd say, obviously, the Lucasfilm movies, Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom. Indiana Jones, not so much The Last Crusade, but I'd say Temple of Doom with some of its like set piece action scenes. And then also like a lot of model work with the mining carts. Let's say Return of the Jedi obviously is one, along with Empire Strikes Back with all the space scenes where, and I would say especially Return of the Jedi with the space battle, the final space battle is unbelievable. Like this is an unbelievable scene, and you go to the situation where that was all literally done like by hand with actual models, essentially with stop motion animation, right?
Yeah, and stop motion and motion control.
Yeah, and then you fast forward to 2023, and you've got these mega productions that are costing 10 times what these other productions have cost. And you've got this kind of obsession with CGI being able to do whatever you want. But the problem is by doing whatever you want, essentially you completely lose the audience because your movie just becomes a cartoon. It might as well be like a Saturday morning cartoon with what's happening on it. And there's so many levels of why it isn't as good. I mean, and I think even 10 years ago, I was talking to you about this in terms of the way that with practical effects, you still had to physically do the thing, right? So you still had to think about the thing and you're doing it. So you know how, and you know, and so you're like, okay, well, could this actually be possible, right? Mm-hmm. Versus, clicking. And then I think the specific movie that we wanted to talk about was, I think, The Flash. Because it's largely so it's I guess 2023 is kind of the year of the flopbuster. And so you've got all these, I think Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny cost, between 250 and 400 million. Didn't make that back at the box office. Multiple Disney movies did not make their box office. Flash also was a huge flop. And was a huge flop again. 200 to 400 million or something like that, and didn't even make that back. You look at Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, budget of 28 million, box office of 250 million, plus all of the merch, the DVD sales, the VHS sales, the Blu-ray sales, the special edition sales, all these sorts of things. And then even to take it back to all the way back to something like the first Terminator movie.
Oh, yeah.
Made by James Cameron in, I think, 1984 or 1983. He was 29 at the time, had been working as a
Effects technician and second unit director.
Exactly. So he knew what he was doing, right? And he knew what he was doing. And so he came and so he knew how to do these things. And then they said, okay, here, buddy. And he said, yeah, here, I've written the script. I want to make it. He had to sell the rights to Terminator 2 or Terminator 1.
Yeah.
He had to sell the rights of Terminator to get the movie made. Budget in that $9 million budget in 1984. Roughly a $20 million budget today. And that again was $9 million, made $78 million at the box office. And then, of course, was followed up by Terminator 2. Terminator 2 was, I think, around a $100 million budget, I think close to $300 million in the box office, so a 3X. And then you look at, and then what's interesting, and this is, this kind of touches on the financialization aspect of the thing, is that Caro Loco, I think, was the name of the company that had the rights.
Caro Loco, yes.
Yeah, it was released under their name. Even with the massive success of Terminator 2, they actually went bankrupt.
Because
of all the other bad things. And what's what, and this is something that ties into, I think, why these movies are getting so bad, is because, you know, Disney can have, you know, whatever, 2023, you know, Disney can have several movies in a row that are massive bombs between Lucasfilm and the Disney, you know, live action remakes that they've been doing. Yet because they are a publicly traded company, they really don't feel the pain. Right. Because of the way that they are funded versus like Caro Loco, you know, they released one of the best sci-fi action movies ever made to this day, yet they went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Right. Because of the all the bad decisions on other movies they had made. Disney has made now, you know, whatever, five flops in a row. And it's not looking pretty for what's coming up. $11 billion on a streaming service that nobody's willing to pay for. And, you know, they're not going like. Disney, by all rights, should be bankrupt right now. And everybody who worked at Disney should lose their jobs. You know, I hate to talk like a radical free market capitalist here, but it's almost like Disney is part of the USSR or something. You know, they don't respond to market signals.
Well, I mean, you say that, but Kennedy
still has a job, right? I mean,
okay,
but you say that, but at the same time, you seem to be forgetting that, like, you know, their business isn't just making movies, right? They have a giant money printing machine, and then they waste a bunch of that in movies. And the tragic part is, because they're so diversified, every dollar they lose making movies, they can use as a tax write-off to ensure that they don't have to pay taxes on the giant money printing machine that they also have called their merchandising and resort operations.
Well, yeah, but again, you got to remember a lot of what people care about, you know, now that they're a publicly traded company, is their stock value. Okay. Right. I'm not going to get into the politics of DEI and box checking and all this kind of stuff. But you know, you look at Bud Light, what happened with them, you know, love or hate their position and that sort of thing. You know, Bud Light did not want to cater to their existing customer base. And so they lost their existing customer base. Disney in the same way I won't talk about necessarily the live action remakes, but with the Star Wars movies, they again decided to essentially not cater to their existing existing customer base. And they've started to lose it. Like some would say that Star Wars itself is now a dead franchise. Like that IP is effectively dead. I mean, it's continuing to go on. There's continuing to make great products with it. But I would say these products were started 3-4 years ago. You know, whereas something like you see Stranger Things watch parties where people are dressing up like the characters and they're young. But young people, I don't think, are into Star Wars in the same way that their parents' generation was. You know, that would be, I say. But yeah, continue on.
Yeah, no, okay, I don't know. Let me just.
Well, let's talk about CGI. Let's talk about CGI.
Well, yeah, but we have to talk about this. Like Star Wars, like I was reading something too one day about how somebody just, I don't know whether when I was talking with you and afterwards I started reading and saying somebody just said, yeah, it was all Lucas's fault anyway with his green screens, right? And starting to use green screens.
Well, that's what I said. I said that to you.
Okay.
Yeah, I said that to you. Yeah.
And then I read some more stuff, right? But this is the problem. I think what we want to talk when we're talking about the CGI problem, because what we're saying is that since they are focusing on CGI, and heaven help us when they start adding AI to it, what's going to happen? They decided to not focus on stories, not focus on anything else. They just said, we can do whatever we want. I mean, I don't even watch half of this stuff anymore. I couldn't stand the last three Star Wars movies. I saw the last one. But the first two, they were so problematic. And it's the storylines that are the problem. And as you say, not catering. You've got a fan base, you know, so this is what we want. And if you're not going to give it to us, and it's not bringing in new people with some of those particular new movies. I don't know everything. I couldn't stand.
Well, that's kind of the Bud Light thing, right?
Let's not talk about the Bud
Light. No. I'm talking about the old fans versus new fans thing.
Yeah, but
Bud Light was essentially, and the person who did Bud Light, she literally said, "Yeah, I don't really like our old customers. We need new customers."
Well, yeah, I don't.
That's what I mean.
Okay.
I'm not talking about the political.
But this is, you know, this is every
discussions around trans.
And can you kick? Whoa. What I want to say is that what happens is that it is part and parcel of trying to go, well, we can just ignore everything in the past. It's a weird phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I hate to bring up the Mission Impossible things, but half the thing is that when you looked at something way back when, you were stunned at what happened because you couldn't imagine how people actually did this. Now
you're talking about the stunts
and everything. Yeah. And the new Mission Impossible, this is the only reason I swear that Tom Cruise still keeps it going is because he does the damn stunts almost entirely himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you're sitting there and there is a real problem. Now, we would have known if he'd hurt himself, and he did once.
He did. Screwed up his ankle on Rogue Nation. Fallout.
Yeah, you can see they've actually shown the footage. You can see
his ankle get destroyed.
Yeah, and so you're going, and it was the same thing with all the other stunts and the stuntmen and stuff. There was a real danger. CGI, you're just going, they're standing in front of a green screen. Pfft, yeah, it's all going to work out. Nobody could possibly do that. And
it's
that's
not
what
even them asked. Standing in front of a green screen. It's a stand-in standing in front of a green screen. And their face is being put on the person.
Yeah, well,
you
that's
know,
a...
I mean, and who cares?
So everybody is Jar Jar Binks now.
Basically. Yeah. It's absolutely true.
So just to point, what I told Sheila was what I specifically said was, I said, you know, Lucas and Spielberg and those movies, they basically brought practical effects and stop motion, all this. They brought it to the peak, like absolute peak, where you're just blown away. And then essentially George Lucas, in his desire to have his pure vision, is like, oh, it's got to be the purest vision. First tried it out with his Star Wars remakes, you know, his re-releases, which I actually never watched them. Just in part, yeah, I know there weren't that many changes, but I personally just didn't, because I didn't.
You boycotted them because you didn't want them to.
I mean, sorry. Yeah. Well, Han shot first. You know, it's like, you know, and I mean, I don't want to go on about. Huh. I don't want to go on for 40 minutes about Han shot first. But imagine some guy writes a book. You know, some author writes a book and it's printed for 20 years and people buy the books and, you know, and then layers later he's like, I'm just going to change this. I'm going to change half the story in this book. And it's just, I guess you could re-release it, but it's not really.
I mean, literally Stephen King did do that with the stand.
Oh, Stephen. Yes. And they were a disaster.
The fact, you know, he supposedly didn't like, you know, The Shining, but, you know, when he did his Shining miniseries that was true to his book, it was terrible. But the whole thing with...
he hated the
Dead Zone. So what I was saying, another great movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Stephen King does not famously have the best taste in movies, I think is the message there.
And so what I was just saying is that George Lucas's, you know, spirit, desire to have his pure, perfect vision... He then set the model for the next 20 years of sci-fi, action, adventure, Marvel, superhero movies by pioneering the 100% green screen movie, you know, and he's kind of responsible for wrecking it all in some ways. You know, he Absolutely. Went to the heights and he wrecked it all.
And he did it out of an obsessive need to control, whereas now that obsessive need to control has been moved over to the executives from the creatives, and that's
why
you're here. Let's face it, say what you will about the prequels, and I don't think they're good. You can tell that they're his ideas on screen. I watch The Flash, and I'm like, I don't know from moment to moment whose idea I'm watching.
Yeah, there's no vision. Yeah, I know. And then I don't know what I'm watching
just from second to second in this movie.
Yeah, and with Lucas. Yeah, I mean, I remember watching a documentary on the making of the first Star Wars, like the first prequel.
Yeah,
and you could see it on everybody's faces because he's just walking.
There's a famous moment. There's a famous moment at the end of that documentary, and you can go see this on YouTube, everybody. It's all over there. You just write first screening of Phantom Menace or and the lights come up and everyone is just kind of shell-shocked because it's true because everybody was just working on a piece of this. Everyone was working on their effect and their little segment and editing their part. And everyone did their best to make their little piece look as good as possible. And none of them realized that if it was all assembled, it would just be, oh my God, what did we do?
Yeah, but nobody was going to go up to George Lucas. I mean, they're all in awe of him. I mean, I would have been, if I was a 20 something working on that film, holy crap. I mean, I would just been like, thank you. Like, this is my dream come true.
Oh,
like,
and it was for all of them.
Ever since I was 10 years old, like that, this is what I wanted to do. And then nobody was going to say, George Lucas, maybe you shouldn't include Scooby-Doo in this movie. Jar Jar Binks, I figured it out. Jar Jar Binks is Scooby-Doo.
He is very similar. No,
he's kind of like dog-like. He's kind of got the funny voice. He's always hungry. Mm-hmm. He's clumsy. He's Scooby-Doo. Yeah.
It's that very much that vibe. 100%. You're completely right about that. Nobody is going to argue that point with you, believe me.
Yeah, no, Jar Jar Binks is Scooby-Doo. 100%.
They added a Scooby-Doo type character because, they wanted something fun for the kids. Because they didn't understand what kids would like. And this is the problem. There is a condescension at the core of those movies that wasn't there in the original. Because he spent the script saying, okay, well, what would kids like? Instead of saying, what do I find cool? Whereas the original movies were just him saying, what do I find cool? And then editors had to go in and say, okay, well, you got to change this and this and this. And this is absolute gibberish. We'll give it to a real sci-fi writer to write the second one.
Okay, but to counter your for the kids thing, you know what kids really love? They really love long, long oration about trade disputes and intergalactic.
But that's his idea. He's got the stuff he wants to talk about, which is how a society falls to fascism. But then he's like, oh, but I got to make sure I get the kids on board. So I'll have a kid main character. And I'll have a bunch of car races and I'll have a Scooby-Doo. And it's like, figure out how to tell your story rather than in a really contrived way saying, okay, well, I want to tell this story about how a society falls to fascism, but also I need to get the kids excited. And then you end up with the awkward mishmash that is The Phantom Menace.
But what I don't get is that kids are... I mean, I was a kid when I saw Star Wars. I loved it. I mean, everybody, because kids don't want it. Kids don't necessarily want to see kid stuff. They want to see Han Solo, and they think that's the man I want to be like. They think, oh, he's got this roguish charm.
And good that's the point I was making about the condescension people enjoy inherent him, to it.
Right?
Because like, in the original, he was thinking, because he stopped thinking things were cool. He stopped watching other things. He stopped having that sense of creativity. This is a dude who watched a ton of serials when he was younger and thought that was cool. And then he watched a ton of samurai movies when he was in college and he thought those were cool. And he's like, what if I put together the sci-fi serials of my kids with the samurai movies I'm watching here in college and we'd really have something? And it was just all the stuff that made him excited. But he wasn't excited by the time he's making Phantom Menace. He is trying to just preserve a brand.
Well, fuck, don't get me started on midichlorians.
Well, that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, God. And then actually, and I would just one last thing about, the Star Wars and the first one. Because I just rewatched Dune, the new Dune 2024. And
right. Maybe
we can podcast about that after the second one comes out and we can talk about the whole thing.
The second one has come out.
No, but I haven't watched it yet. I'm waiting until it streams, right?
I understand.
But I'm just waiting until it streams. Of course. And I haven't seen it yet. So, but But I, you know, rewatching the Dune movie, I kind of like, I feel like George Lucas did pick a bunch up from Dune
within,
for Star Wars. It's, you know, Tatooine, the sandy place, it's very dry. There's the Bene Gesserit who have the voice and the skill that they learn. That's this kind of force-like thing. I mean, they can't, they don't move things, you know, and then, you know, but it, in, and even with the within Dune, it's this this boy who's not supposed to have the powers, but his mother gave them or has taught him how to use these powers. So, and then I realized, and like because they kind of taught, they instead of saying the force, they say the voice, right?
So it is so very similar.
So I do feel like they kind of he picked up. I mean, obviously
he would have. It's easy enough for him to have read Dune.
Everybody read Dune. Like all way sci-fi.
Oh no! I mean, of course they all read Dune.
You know. So, you know, I think here's the thing. I mean, the whole point that we were going to start with was that CGI is making superhero movies boring.
Sci-fi, just
sci-fi, boring. And I'm going, okay, so let's talk Fury Road.
Oh, that was amazing.
Fury Road. Fury Road. I know it can be used. Absolute masterpiece, Fury Road. Everybody should go and see it.
They built a lot of those cars, though. They actually built almost those cars.
Well, no, but that's the point, is all of the background CGI? Yes. Have all the wires been CGI removed with CGI? Yes. But everything people are doing is people actually doing those things. And you can tell the difference.
Not in a green screen.
Yeah.
They're not in a green screen.
That's exactly the point. And I just, it breaks my heart because it can still be, you can still do good movies. And it's not like it would cost an awful lot of money.
Well, I mean,
you know, I think CGI costs more.
It actually, that's what I was going to say. As far as I understood, I looked into The Flash. Apparently, it had a $65 million CGI or effects budget within its larger $220 million thing. And I, you know, and I was talking to a friend of mine about some of this stuff. And she's an animator, so she works on things like Paw Patrol and those kinds of shows and other ones. And I guess her and her husband are more focused on modeling and surfacing. So they're not doing the step-by-step animation. So, but yeah, she said, yeah, like essentially producers and these kinds of people, showrunners, they have no clue how anything is done. Right. And I think what they do is, and again, that's the James Cameron coming from a technical background. He learned his art and then he applied it in his movie. Whereas I think that what happens is these people come into the movie sets or the studio and they just see a bunch of people sitting in front of computers, clicking mouse buttons and fiddling with their computer. And they're just like, okay, well just make me something that looks cool. You know, like, honestly, I think that's it. And then they just go away and they're like, oh yeah, you can just do this really fast, right? This is fast to do. Don't you like somebody, apparently somebody said they had a month to do the CGI on Flash or something like that.
Well, I mean that's actually a big part of the problem with Flash. Like you is that when you were doing stuff practically, right? You had to know exactly what you wanted, like exactly.
Yeah.
A year before you shot the thing. You know, you had to have already made the storyboards that you were going to shoot a year earlier. So the effects people had time to build the models and make sure the models were to scale and to start photographing that photography test to make sure it would look good. Whereas with CGI, there is this whole idea that they're going to fix everything in post.
Like,
that is what is doing a lot of the killing. They're like, oh, well, we don't have to really know what we're doing when we start the movie because we can fix it later.
We'll just. Yeah, but that's the same. It's the same thing with like, it was the same with software releases. Software releases go up buggy because they know they can fix them afterwards.
Oh, exactly. The problem is we're talking about movies here. And that's like software releases to a certain extent, you can fix it later. With a movie, if you're not starting with exactly what you want to do, well, then you can't possibly be telling a compelling story, can you?
No.
Like here's something that bothers me about The Flash, right? It's a terrible movie by all, like there's no means in which this is in any way a high quality film. It is just bizarre by any description. But one of the things that bothers me most about the movie is that they're focusing on all of this nonsense kept them from noticing like giant plot holes in the center of their movie. So the entirety of the film is about him trying to create evidence that his dad didn't kill his
first
mother.
Well, no, first
wait, hold on. Dad didn't kill his mother, right?
Yes, you're right. Yes.
He's now my point, I think, is that you're the Flash. Just break him out of jail. Who cares? You know, break him out of jail. Have Batman give him a new identity. You're done. Right. This is not a problem. But anyway,
okay.
What bothered me about the movie is no one thought about it to the extent that they had the mother get stabbed, presumably by the Reverse Flash. I don't know, but get stabbed.
By the way, there are. Well, that's the thing.
Let me finish. Then you can talk.
Yeah.
They have the mother get stabbed 10 seconds before the father walks into the house with the can of tomatoes that he went out to buy. And the whole thing is about buying a can of tomatoes, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And the mother literally bleeds to death in his arms, right? The mother literally bleeds to death in his arms. And my point is, he spends the entire movie trying to figure out a way to make it clear, right? And his first idea is just remember to put tomatoes in the thing so he does the cart so he doesn't go back out later.
Well, no,
and
because he had to do minimal.
Yes,
minimal.
I'm still making my point. I'm still making my point. Put tomatoes in the canister. Oh my God. In the cart so he doesn't have to leave. Right. Yeah. And so that is his first plan. And that creates another timeline. But my point is, and then Reverse Flash doesn't stab her. So yay. But then at the end, his solution is put the things on the top shelf so his face is on the camera so they'll know he was in the store. But my problem is, and this is what nobody thought about, he still wasn't at the store when she got stabbed. She still got stabbed when he was pulling the car into the driveway. She still got stabbed, bled to death in his arms.
What was the timeline, though? I forgot.
That's my point.
I thought you got stabbed when?
No.
No, because what? Was the kid upstairs? Where was he? With the child?
The kid's upstairs.
So she was lying there for half an hour.
No, it's not half an hour. Listen to me. He hears the stabbing. The father runs in the door and the son runs downstairs at the same time. They've literally missed the stabbing by 30 seconds. But no one making the movie noticed that all of the stuff he did to change the history accomplished nothing.
Nothing. Well, anyway, so that's pretty funny.
And then,
the
villain Savitar, who's just annoying as hell. Never liked Savitar.
I don't know who that is.
But it's a comic book thing. They never call him Savitar, but he's a dude. They did it on the TV show a little better. A time clone of Barry Allen who becomes a monster. Anyway.
I never was interested in DC comics, really. I'd say Batman was interesting because he's sort of like this.
First Batman movie was really cool.
The first Batman movie is boss as hell.
Yeah.
Let me just throw together some notes.
Yeah.
And please. I mean, so first off, you're watching, he's this weirdo autistic guy, which I guess somehow is supposed to be, you know, entertaining to millennials or something. Cause they all seem to think they have problems. Then they have annoying 70s music a la Guardians of the Galaxy. Right. Then he steps outside and it's like, everybody's, oh my God, it's a Flash. Like, so I don't know what that's about. Is a commentary on the nature of stardom or something. And apparently the actor is batshit crazy.
Oh yeah. Legit crazy person.
Apparently he's completely insane.
It seems like for all of the money they spent, you know, doing this movie, they could have just like popped somebody else into that movie with green screen with no trouble at all.
No. Well, I mean, the thing is, yeah. So I'll say it seemed to me like almost every 10 minutes in this, every 10 minute section of this movie, there was some sort of over the top, you know, enormous spectacle of like CGI. It was unending. It was never ending. Like again, you know, and then flipping back
crashes and the
flipping back to Temple of Doom. They have a fight in a bar.
Mm-hmm.
He jumps out of a plane. They fall into the river, you know, and then they
and then we have, got no effects for half an hour.
Yeah.
None
but
whatsoever.
Even then it's just sets. It's just really nice sets. And then really the only real effects. And then I'd say the last half hour of Indiana Jones and Doom is amazing. You've got, I mean, that's it. You've got the
masterpiece of virtual set building with those miniatures.
Oh my God. Yeah. And cutting back and forth between the miniatures and the real people. And,
it's uncannily well done.
And then when the water bursts out of the rock face
and it starts tearing up the wall behind them. Yeah.
Well, but it's a matte painting.
Oh yeah. And
the wide shot, the wide angle matte painting, can't even tell it's a matte painting, really.
Oh yeah.
And then I've worked in the film business, you know, more on the set building side and set design side. So I know, like, I'm watching and I can see that's foam and I can see all the stuff on. Like, I can see the way it's all built.
You can see the bricks of styrofoam flying off.
Or whatever. It doesn't matter. But, no, you know,
you believe it.
Yeah, you believe it. And the thing is, and then I don't know how high those actors were standing off the ground.
Yeah.
But I didn't see any wires on them. I didn't see anything. The whole scene with them climbing up the rope ladder, the ladder when they're on the wall. I don't know where they must have been tied off somehow.
They are tied off and they are using old pre-CGI techniques to paint out the frame by frame to paint out the wires that are holding them.
Yeah. Okay. So like Tron, where they colored in everything frame by frame.
Oh yeah.
Because this Flash movie, and I think it's kind of like, I'd say the Marvels, which was even a bigger flop than Flash was. And that's a whole other thing. They literally, they literally took this woman who directed, I think, a couple of episodes of a TV show, and they said, oh, here you go. Here's a $250 million budget movie for you to do. Apparently she walked away during the final editing. She didn't even stick around to do the editing, but that's a whole other, we can talk about that later. But I feel like this Flash movie is like, it's the penultimate
example of this. Yeah.
An example of just, it's like, this is the penultimate, like, cause it's got all the cliches. Mm-hmm. It's got all the nonsense, right? It's got all the stuff. It's got the nostalgia throwbacks. everybody's a comedian, the nostalgia throwbacks, like, referencing things in the real world, you know, like in a joking way, breaking the fourth wall, like it's all there. Like, yeah, so it's like weirdo autistic, annoying 70s music like Guardians of the Galaxy, because it did well with Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, people bought that soundtrack, right? So, you know, everybody's cheering because he's the Flash, it's a superhero. The running looks ridiculous. And then, of course, as he's running, so it goes from like he's in the coffee shop and it's like playing, you know, some 70s song, starts running. All of a sudden, it's just like heavy metal song that's supposed to somehow, you know what I mean? Like
tune you up for the
tune you up. Like, oh my God, it's heavy metal. Like, oh my God, it's crazy. This is so intense. He's running fast. Like, imagine that, running fast.
I picked a good one.
Yeah. You know, and then it's like, you know, constant snarky comments. No one appreciates me, lol. Then you have the whole baby scene. And this is where it gets into the total like insane uncanny valley where, you know, again, like
it all looked like a cartoon suddenly. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's ridiculous. And then they throw the baby in a microwave and you're just not interested. Like, in no sense are you.
It's all so abstract and so silly that you can't even enjoy yourself.
You're just removed
from any human experience that you're like, I don't even know what I'm watching.
And then he catches all the babies and puts them on a medical whatever table, you know, like a gurney or whatever it is. Is it supposed to be funny? Was I supposed to laugh at this? I don't know what emotions I was supposed to experience. Like, am I supposed to be afraid for the babies?
I think that was the idea.
And it's got that whole uncanny valley thing, right? Because the babies,
they look like weird dolls.
Yeah, maybe if they had more time, they could have made them look more real, because they clearly have, I think just before they fly out the window, spoiler alert, before they fly out the window.
You don't have to give a spoiler alert for a 2-year-old movie that everyone hated.
It was last year, dude, 2023. It's 2024 last time.
Well, it was technically made in like 2019, but yes.
Are you serious?
Yes.
They spent forever on post-production. Oh, all of that guy's crime spree happened while they were editing the movie.
That's so funny. I guess he won't be working again. Anyways. Yeah. So then he said something like, and this was so funny because he had this whole thing where he then goes to the nurse, and it kind of reminded me of RoboCop, you know, when RoboCop saves that woman.
Yeah.
And he shoot, you know, and then she's screaming. He's like, I suggest you seek mental health help.
He says, contact a rape crisis center.
Yeah. And so he does the same thing.
Basically.
Right. Then you cut to Batman and his whole scene. Batman seems to now have superpowers. I mean, he's being like thrown against. He's like the guys are driving 100 miles an hour. Batman's being thrown against like cars. Like,
yeah.
Just like
stupid.
I didn't know that he was Superman now.
Basically, like, everyone has superpowers now.
Yeah.
Like, in every movie.
You know, they have lost any
conception of what the limits of human endurance and physicality are. That's just gone by the way.
I mean, that's why Batman was always a more interesting character, because he had that limitation. Mm-hmm. Superman movies to me were always kind of boring, and Superman just in general was boring because, well, he can do anything. Well, okay, well then why is anything ever a challenge for him, right? You know, he could even turn back time and, you know, save, what's her face. So
that's why Superman's best version is the 1960s Superman, when he was a lovable trickster god who just went around playing pranks on people.
Well, there you go.
That's my Superman.
So then, of course, Wonder Woman shows up to save the day. Cause I guess everybody loves that actress. I don't know. And then she whips the rope around them. And then Batman's like, oh, maybe I should solve poverty. And I've got so much trauma. Like, what? So everybody's just like, what? Then, you know, and then he's got a dead parent. And then, honestly, referencing RoboCop again, he walks into his old house.
And he has that memory thing.
Yeah. He has that memory thing. And it's totally RoboCop. Like, it's absolutely RoboCop. Oh, yeah. You know, and then they go 25 minutes in, this is when he's doing that time shift thing where he walks into it's almost like this time coliseum. I don't even know what it is.
The coliseum of the, you know, the time zones. Yeah. It's very strange.
To me, it looks like a coliseum almost, right? Maybe it's supposed
it's
to be
designed to.
I don't even know what they were thinking, but.
Yeah, you know, it's a weird one.
And of course, it's so murky. You can't see anything. All this blue and red, like just so, like the fire, the flames look bad. The electrical effects look bad. Everything looks terrible.
Oh yeah,
compared to compared to Return of the Jedi, where Luke is getting zapped by the force lasers, mm-hmm. or whatever, force beams. So RoboCop again, 25 minutes in, he does this terrible floating head graphic. You know, like where his head like. Coase is sitting there and there's flames around it and he's looking at himself at the hospital. Like, what is going on? 46 minutes in, they have another annoying old song. And then it turns out this movie is actually Back to the Future. Who knew? You know, like, what? Turns out we're watching, it's a remake of Back to the Future. Because then, you know, then because he walks in and sees his friends are all like stoners or something, or like just like wastrels. And they're like, oh, yeah, Eric Stoltz is in, because they're referring to the fact that in the real world, Eric Stoltz was supposed to play Marty McFly.
Marty McFly. They shot everything except for the dance.
Yeah, which is nuts. I mean, I only found that out a couple of years, like 3 years ago or something. Yeah,
they shot everything except for the dance. And so there are actually shots in that movie where it's not Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, they think it's clever, and instead of it just being a pastiche, and one day we should talk about what's his name. I'd love to discuss. There's actually a couple of things we could do podcasts on. Is also Quentin Tarantino. And how he pioneered the pastiche method of
he makes remixes. That's what he does.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, you and I are 100% on board with this. Yeah, he produced the remix method of making movies.
Yeah,
and then also, and the way that Judd Apatow was in a way responsible for the death of the comedy movie, the death of the well-written scripted comedy movie, right? And I think that you could bookend those two things with Ghostbusters 1984 and Ghostbusters 2016. And essentially what happened was that Judd Apatow took Freaks and Geeks, I guess he's a good writer, but essentially what happened was I think Judd Apatow took This is Spinal Tap and then turn that into how you make comedy movies.
What he did was he embraced the he hired a bunch of improvisers and he let them improvise and he fell so in love with the improvisation, he forgot to make a movie.
Exactly. There you go. Dude, you and me are right on the same
And that can actually work kind of with a comedy, but you need an unbelievably good editor and you have to have people keep their eyes on the story and they don't do that anymore. And that's why the new Ghostbusters, the 2016 Ghostbusters was such a disaster because every scene, the director in that case, I think Paul Feig, couldn't bear to cut any of their jokes.
Oh, like, God.
You're trying to tell a story here.
And that's what I'm talking about. And that's what I mean. You take Ghostbusters 1984, Ghostbusters 2018, and you see what happened in between that. And you could tell, and I enjoyed the movie This Is 40. I thought it was kind of enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But at the end, you can see, I kind of understood, because I don't know if I really understood that that was the way he was making his movies. But then when I saw the credits of This Is 40, they have all these cuts of all, you know, Melissa McCarthy just saying, talking shit for like 20 minutes or whatever it is. Yeah. Just basically just yelling and swearing. And then because I kind of picked up on that with the movie Knocked Up and, you know, Seth Rogen. And then I kind of was like, Judd Apatow seems to have this thing where at some point in the movie, one of his characters will just start swearing incessantly for like 2 minutes. And you're like, oh, is this funny? Like, is this supposed to be funny? Is this like, what's going on here?
Because on the set, everyone laughed. And so he remembered it being entertaining to them. So he ensures that that gets put through the edit, even though it's just gibberish just watching it.
Versus Ghostbusters 1984 which is kind of like a impeccably well-crafted comedy movie that probably went through many script revisions and was narrowed down. I think Dan Aykroyd said it was supposed to be originally like Ghost Catchers or something. It was set on the moon or something weird. I don't know.
He did all sorts of strange stuff with that first draft. And fundamentally, I think the key there is what infects a lot of these movies is they start making a movie again. And I mean, it's the phenomenon I describe as movies are being made by spreadsheets.
Yeah.
Which is that they start a movie without really any sense of what they want to, the movie they want to make, other than the fact that they have a hole in their distribution window. The most famous example is the terrible Ant-Man movie, Quantumania, which was started out because they said, we want to make something in the microverse and we need to introduce Kang. So what can we do with that? And then someone said, well, we don't have an Ant-Man movie on the, you know, on the schedule. So let's just make that an Ant-Man movie. There's no reason Ant-Man should be the star of that movie. Like, it doesn't make sense. Ant-Man movies up to that point had been charming, low stakes heist films.
Yeah. Apparently it also has this like annoying social justice teenager character who like talks back to her parents and is like going to be a farmer or something.
Blank Reg is going on record being against teenagers talking back to their parents. For history's sake, get him on record being against teenagers sassing their parents.
About disrespect.
Want to point out that what Blank Reg is doing right now is literally quoting Socrates. Just putting there that. No, go. Sorry. Literally quoting Plato in the Republic, complaining about how teenagers don't stand up when their elders enter the room. Just want to put that out there.
Well, again,
that's where that's all coming from.
You gotta see the scene. Anyways.
But anyway, that's.
let me finish. So back to Flash.
Yeah.
The whole thing with the pastiche is that, so what I said was they think it's clever instead of just a pastiche because they refer to how in this universe Eric Stoltz is Marty McFly. Because they think what they're doing, we're being self-referential and we're being kind of like self-aware that we exist in the world and this is the real world, but it's not. And then, you know, fast forward, I don't even remember what happens between the Marty, you know, honestly, like you said, and then they have that, they go and find Batman. Oh, look, it's a throwback reference. And it turns out that the Batman in this universe is the Batman from
Tim Burton's Batman.
From Tim Burton's Batman. Like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, what? Like, what's going on? This is crazy. And don't you love fan service? We're thrown back to all those fans of that 1989, like Batman.
Horrendous thing.
I mean, I still enjoy it, but you know, this is funny. Batman's like, great. But is that fan service? Like, are there do people actually like, cause I almost feel, cause there's been so many goddamn Batman movies made and so many different people playing him. I mean, I'm sure, who knows? Maybe they asked Christian Bale to be in this one. I probably didn't.
Oh, no.
Because George Clooney shows up at the end, right? But
yeah, that was a very late reshoot. So, fun fact, this is, I think, acknowledging that it's that Batman really it messed me up because then I'm watching these scenes, you know, set in his Batcave, and it's not a very good sequence. Is Michael Keaton. It's always nice to see Michael Keaton playing Batman again. I'm not going to pretend they didn't get me. No, I'm not going to pretend I'm better than that. But the thing that really bothered me when I'm watching that scene, right, is how it stresses to me how little they understand the thing they're making. Because they're going through his room of trophies. And they're like, he's got a laughing bag. What could that mean? And that's supposed to be a reference to at the end of the movie Batman when the Joker has fallen off of the giant church. And he's fallen off the giant church and you're still hearing a laughing and they pull this bag out of his jacket. And I'm like, how little do you have to understand that movie to not get that there was a tape recorder in that bag? Mm-hmm. It wasn't a laughing bag. It was a tape recorder in a silk bag. It's not like, what would a laughing bag be? What the hell are you talking about, movie?
So by the way,
that one really bothered me for some reason. Yeah.
So then after they meet, you know, whichever universe Batman this is.
Yes.
Then they go into this whole, like, you know, they do the fighting and I guess there's some funny moments in the fighting again. I don't think I ever really even smiled at any of the things that happened in this movie, except in maybe a bemused way, I would say. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Batman's now like a hoarder who, like, you know, paints bad paintings or something. Yeah, like he's a crap.
He murdered all the criminals and now there's no crime in Gotham City.
Yeah. So the funny thing is that, and then he sits down and then for some reason he knows about time travel and how you can screw things up.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh yeah, because then if you start bending things, it also changed the past. Who knows why? Apparently I don't know why that it also changes the past, but apparently he's not only, time, he's also shifting dimensions or something.
They would have done a much better version of explaining that you can't actually change the past. They tried to say that it affects the past, but it doesn't. That's not what's happening in the movie. What's happening in the movie is when you go back and you change the past, you're actually moving yourself to a dimension where it happened that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So but then at the end of the movie, he is just changing the past. The film has no idea, like, has no conception of what its own rules are.
Well, of course not. Yeah, there's no internal logic to anything. No. And that's probably the biggest problem with so many movies today is that there's no internal logic anymore.
It is a big issue.
There has to be, and again, this guy Despot of Antrim, like, he talks about it. This is the thing he talks about. He said, you know, whatever your universe is, there has to be rules within this universe that exists. And that you have to obey your own rules of the universe you're creating. Create you whatever universe you want, but at least be internally consistent within that universe, you know? So that's
or it. Or else you don't have a movie. That's absolutely right.
You know, so within this little discussion where he's talking about time travel, he does some kind of dig at the Marvel multiverse.
Yeah.
He literally says, and then you've got a multiverse and that's just a big mess or whatever. Yeah. And then the joke I thought was that they poke fun at the Marvel universe concept
while
and then they make
their own.
Yeah. And then they make their own multiverse.
It's very embarrassing.
Very. Yes. And there's frankly, you know, for all the complaints one can make about Marvel movies, most of them are better than this.
No, all of them are better than this. Yeah. You can go to those movies and turn off your brain and have a good time. Whereas this is just
This is garbage.
I'll tell you right now, Flash did better at the box office than the Marvels did. So
yeah, but you can actually enjoy watching the Marvels. You can't enjoy watching Flash.
Have you watched the Marvels?
I have watched the Marvels.
Yeah. Oh, you did?
It's fine. Oh, okay. It's not great, but it's fine. I mean, there's a couple of good scenes. There's a lot of cute cats in it.
Yeah.
The Miss Marvel is a, you know, continually likable character. Like, yeah, there's plenty of good stuff in that movie. It's just way too bloated. And to a certain extent suffers from the same problem, some of the same problems of Flash, is that they have no idea whose story they're telling or what story they're trying to tell.
Well, that was the kind of joke. Some people said that the Marvels could have been the first movie written by ChatGPT.
No, that I would like say that. The Flash is definitely that.
Well, so, but it's funny. No, but I'll tell you right now. So yeah. I've got this old blaxploitation movie that I used to watch back in the day.
Which one's that?
Called The Guy from Harlem.
That cat's a bad dude. Yes, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
Starring Loy Hawkins. Yeah, I'm very familiar with The Guy from Harlem.
By the way, if you are going to be in, I think it's Maryland, or anyway, if look him up, he's going to be playing live in something like, I don't know, like Maryland or something. He's doing a live show because he's a jazz musician. I don't know if you knew that, but he actually has like a jazz band.
That's fantastic.
I was like, a friend of mine told me that he was going to be playing live. It's like July 27th. And I was like, wow. You know, if I was a millionaire, I would literally buy a ticket just to go see
Loy Hawkins. Yeah.
And I would bring a copy of a poster for the guy from Harlem. And I would ask him to sign,
for him to sign it. Well, if anyone wants to see The Guy from Harlem, it's on YouTube completely for free right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can also buy the DVD watch it for $9.99. Right, I think it's at Grindhouse. It's got Grindhouse Pictures or something. There's some website that sells all these Grindhouse movies from back in the day.
Well, don't
anyways, but I'll tell you. So right now, I went to ChatGPT. And so I was kind of joking around with my friends about The Guy from Harlem. And I said, I wonder if we could get ChatGPT to write The Guy from Harlem, because it's basically
shocked me.
It's so bad, right? And I literally wrote a description of a specific scene, like with two of the meaning. I'm like, there's this guy and there's this guy and these are the names, and one of them's from the CIA, one guy's white, one guy's black, they used to live in Harlem, they played football, they said these lines. And and there's an African princess, you know, all the shit.
And how did ChatGPT do?
I'll forward it to you. It did actually really, really well. And I would just type. It's like, you know, remember that they say this specific line about he scored, I scored with the ladies. Like, add that line in there, and it did really well. Like, for a blaxploitation 1970s terrible blaxploitation movie, I think ChatGPT is. You could do it. Like,
what you got to remember is most of those movies weren't written so much as terribly improv by people who were bad at improv on the day. So I'm not surprised that a computer that has read every screenplay ever written could probably do a better job than people who aren't actors trying to make up lines on the fly. That's not a shock to me.
You should read the internet. No, I found a review. The Guy from Harlem, where that guy basically said that. It's just like, it's bad. Yeah. And obviously it got from everything was one take.
Oh, of course.
We used to joke that it was a porn movie with no sex.
Yeah, it's like, a lot of black. Well, it has that aesthetic. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. So,
but anyway, so let me just say it.
We're going to
be.
No, please. We're going to be. Please continue.
I was just going to say, can we kind of get back to CGI versus
we're gonna wrap this up now with an anecdote, which I want to point out about the genius that having these real things can have, right? The effect that it can have on youth. And I'm gonna use an example of this to wrap this up. And this is, I think, one of the problems with the modern age of CG is they're not creating images that are gonna stick with people. And I think I'm glad you chose Temple of Doom, because Temple of Doom is a perfect example of something that a sequence where the model work and the storytelling, the visuals are so compelling that they stuck in people's minds for the rest of their lives. And a perfect example of this is there's a game called Resident Evil 4, right? And in this game, Resident Evil 4, there is a minecart sequence. And the thing that blew my mind when I was playing it was that, oh my God, this feels, and this is back in 2003, 2004, this feels like I am in the Temple of Doom, right? And that is, and it occurred to me as I was playing it that like somebody, when they were 10 years old, you know, living in Japan, saw the movie The Temple of Doom, and the rest of their life, it stuck with them. And they were always thinking about that sequence a little. And when they got into making video games, they're like, this is my chance to like live Temple of Doom, this iconic sequence from this iconic movie from their life. Right.
Yep.
And like, so they devoted that kind of moment, that kind of like real building thing to make it feel fully authentic, to make people want to be there, made that person more creative. And allowed them to create their own art influenced by Temple of Doom years later. And then another 20 years later, you know, they made another Resident Evil. And now you can play that minecart sequence in VR. And it literally feels like you are in Temple of Doom. Like 40 years after Temple of Doom. Now you can put on a VR headset and you're inside Temple of Doom. It is one of the most amazing things I've seen. But that's the power of this kind of imagination. Of giving people a chance to see something unique and letting an artist do something unlike you've ever seen before. So yeah, it's, that is what we're losing because, and the point I'm making is no one 20 years from now is going to be so affected by a moment they saw in The Flash that it's going to lead them to create their own magnificent piece of iconic art that goes and changes an entire genre. Cause that's what Resident Evil 4 did. It completely changed video games because these people had been affected by these movies that had changed their lives. And that's what we're losing with this churn of CGI gibberish.
Yeah. I feel like we're making, I mean, Hollywood is making $250 million B movies.
Yeah.
Like that's all to say. It's might as well be Ed Wood.
They're not even like the thing is B movies. You might find something that sparks your imagination. Now it's not even that they're B movies. It's what I always say. It is a movie made by a spreadsheet. It is a movie made by money people who know that they have to have a movie come out at this date. And so they just say, okay, well, what are the products we have access to? What can we, you know, how can we exploit this IP we own? Blah, 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 blah. How can we make the most amount of money with the least amount of outlay, and creativity never enters the conversation. And if you want to see a perfect example of this, go watch Space Jam 2, but don't pay for it. Steal Space Jam 2.
Yeah, but well, except the problem is that the you say minimum amount of outlay, they're spending $250 million on these things, like Indiana Jones, and here one last thing about the Flash's. Again, pastiche. So, because they again, and this is where they think they were being clever or something, or referencing like Back to the Future, because then later on he's like, I need my powers back, and then they literally like, I need to get jolted by electricity
because that's so what happened in Back to the Future.
Yeah, like oh no, like but of course in Back to the Future. It was this whole thing where it was had to be a very specific time and da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
Whereas in The Flash, it's just like Batman sends up like a bat, you know.
Lightning rod,
and somehow it magically gets a...
Creates a thunderstorm, I know.
Like what? That is just like, oh, I'm just like, oh my God, this is so bad. Like, what is going on here? And then, yeah, and then I think just to end my... Just talking about the ridiculous, because I saw the end. I was like, and I guess technically he's, you know, in the end, he actually makes himself responsible for his own mother's death, right? In the end.
Because, no, I mean, not really. It was already going to happen. He just fails to stop it.
Well, but then I thought a better way to do it is that he actually went in there and stabbed her. And I think that you were kind of like saying that.
That is not what, but just for case people haven't seen the movie, that is not what happens.
No, but you kind of made that point that creature that he, you know, his alter ego becomes or whatever, you know, who's apparently has lived for like a million years and is trying to, who knows, whatever, is trying to fix it all.
Yeah.
I think you kind of said like, yeah, the perfect way to have done it.
Wrap it up would have that be. Yeah.
That guy, that person or whoever that thing is, him actually comes and kills his own mother. That would have been
to create, to force his own creation. But that would have required the movie to think about something. Well, that is not what that movie was good at.
But he does actually say, like, that character does say, I was, because remember when he goes back, when he's trying to go back forward in time.
Yeah.
Right?
He ends so up.
The creature knocks
him out. He knocks Flash out into his timeline to give him powers because that's the only way he can exist.
Yeah. And he actually literally says, isn't it crazy that I had to like push you out of the timeline, but I didn't even exist yet. Like he literally, he does actually kind of talk about that.
We understand about, bootstrap nonsense. All right. So I want to thank you for joining us for this special episode.
It's over? Oh my God.
Yes, it is ending. I know it's crazy, but we've been here for an hour. So
for the record, last chance. So yeah, so Disney is still profitable, but they are still profitable, but at the same time, when you are running a business and you take something like Lucasfilm that in Star Wars, which was probably one of the best IPs in the world at that time, and you turn into something that is now no longer making you money, it still does enter into a calculation. Like they still should be it's a write-off, but you took literally the most valuable movie and television IP and you destroyed it.
Spoiler alert. George Lucas is the one who destroyed the value of Star Wars as an IP with the prequels and the fact that he spent 5 years doing pre-production of a Star Wars TV show that he never actually made. let's not pretend Star Wars was in a great shape when Disney bought it. There hadn't been a new Star Wars product in a decade. And people were at the brink of like forgetting that Star Wars exists. Let's not pretend that it was like the jewel of a crown when it was bought by Disney.
Still a very valuable IP. They could have, and they, I'm sorry, but they need to retcon those 7, 8, 9. They just need to pretend.
All right. Okay. So
I agree.
And on that note, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com to share us your opinions on what's going on with Star Wars, The Flash, and CGI. We're going to be back here on Thursday with a new episode of Millennium. We'll see you there. But until then, I'll say that's right. Au revoir.
Yeah. And also, let me just say thank you very much for having me on, guys. I'd like all the listeners to send in a little poll of my own. Just ask if you'd like Blank Reg to return to the show at some point in the future to discuss other things. I think
we've got to hear from you about that.
Got a good vibe here. Sort of a plus minus. Okay.